This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On a volcanic island in Indonesia, the Lamalaran tribe has fought to preserve an ancient language and a tradition. The community is thought to be the last subsistence whaling tribe in the world, and it's a community that Doug Bach Clark knows well. Over the course of 3 years, Doug spent time with the Lamalarans. He learned their language and came to understand their culture and the connection they had to the natural world. He captures those stories in his new book, The Last Whalers, 3 years in the Far Pacific with a Courageous Tribe and a Vanishing Way of Life. Doug Bach Clark is a writer whose articles have appeared in The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and Foreign Policy, many, many more. Doug, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
How did you learn about the Lamalarans?
Well, I was living in Indonesia shortly after graduating from college in a remote part of the archipelago. It was not quite as remote as where the Lamalarans live, but it was nearby. And so when I heard stories of this group of people who hunt sperm whales with bamboo harpoons, I decided I had to go and see this for myself.
So where'd you go? Describe the island for us and what it takes to get there.
So I was probably living about 200 miles away at that point, and it took me about a week to travel from the island that I was living on to the island that the Lamalarans live on. And the way that I had to do that was sort of travel down a chain of islands, and you'd take a small bus to a ferry, and then the ferry would bring you to the next island, and so on and so forth. And with each island, the roads got progressively worse, and the ferries took progressively longer to get to the next island, until finally got to almost the end of the island chain, and then I took a dump truck up and over a volcano through the jungle, and I arrived at a very small community of about 1,500 people called Lamalara.
I want to find out more about them, and I'm going to pause here because we think of Indonesia, and we say Indonesia, and that is one word, and it describes everybody who lives there. But the isolation that you just described suggests to me a wide variety of cultures, languages, just ways of living.
Indonesia is one of the most culturally diverse places in the world. It's one of the most economically diverse places in the world. It's a nation made up of about 13,000, give or take, islands that stretch all the way from Southeast Asia to Australia and then a little bit further on. So on one end of the scale, you have places like Jakarta, which is a city of 25 million people and one of the most populated, overpopulated places on the earth, which is just as technologically rich as the United States. But then not far away, many of the outlying islands are extremely undeveloped. There are supposedly people in parts of Papua New Guinea, which is an island that Indonesia half owns, which are not contacted yet. And then you have groups like the Lamalarans who still keep traditions and ways of life that are significantly different than modern ways.
So talk about those ways of life.
So the Lamalarans survive by hunting sperm whales with bamboo harpoons. And they do so with these ancient wooden ships that are called taina. And every day when they see sperm whales out in the ocean beyond their village, they will row out with their boats. And when they approach the whales, a man will get on the front of the boat and on what's essentially a diving platform. And then he will run down the diving platform and leap off and use his body weight to push a bamboo harpoon into a 50 or 60 foot sperm whale.
That sounds like a hard thing to do. And exceptionally dangerous.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a very hard way of life.
And it's been going on. Tell you roughly how much do we know about how long this has been going on?
It's been going on for at least 5 centuries.
Wow.
There are historical records of various form that that corroborate that. And incredibly, as you were mentioning, it's a very hard way of life, but this used to be a way of life that was shared all over the world in some senses. American whaling ships actually used to travel to the area right outside this island in order to hunt whales when we were a whaling nation in order to get the spermaceti to make candles. So Moby Dick, for example, the voyage of the boat in Moby Dick passes very near this island. The Pequod was chasing Moby Dick in this area. And so, you know, it's it's a way of life that still continues in that area, even though it has vanished elsewhere.
So what happens now? Describe the rest of the process. One whaler leaps from this board, uses his body weight to jam a bamboo harpoon into a sperm whale, which is how big?
It can be anywhere from maybe 40 to 60 feet. They're the world's largest carnivores, and they are not happy when they get speared.
Yeah, and that first one didn't do the trick, did it?
The first one certainly did not. The blubber of a whale can be about a foot thick, so it's very, very tough to land any sort of blow that's going to seriously hurt the whale the first time. So the goal of the whalers is to just embed the harpoon, and then a rope from the harpoon's head will extends from the harpoon head to the boat, meaning that the whale cannot get away. The whalers are then attached.
Yeah, neither can the boat.
Neither can the boat. And so sometimes, often, you know, I went on dozens of these hunts, and often the boats will be destroyed or flipped. And what ensues after the first harpoon is landed is often hours of basically a running battle between the fleet and the whale. More boats will then try and attach themselves to the whale with harpoons. And eventually the tribe essentially overwhelms it. You know, it's death by a thousand cuts and not a single killing blow.
About how many hunters would be involved in this?
It can vary widely, but usually in dozens. It usually would take dozens, maybe 50 or so whalers to overwhelm.
And about how far are they from the island when they encounter the whale in general, or does it vary widely?
It can vary, vary quite widely. They live on beside a unique deep water strait that channels whale migrations, which is partially why their culture has evolved in this way. So often from shore, or when they're fishing or hunting smaller animals closer to shore, you can see the spouts of the whales far in the distance, which is a signal for everyone to drop what they're doing and go whaling.
It's a dramatic moment, actually. You describe that when someone sees or knows that a whale is present, right?
It's very dramatic. When someone sights a whale spout, they will yell baleo, 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 which means bring the whaling ropes. And the whole village will rush down to the beach, and they have different kind of boats, but for that moment they will launch the ancient whaling boats, and everyone will push them out. And then they will just start chasing the whales. And so
And they don't have their evinrudes. They're paddling.
Well, so that can differ. There are two kinds of boats now. Until the early 2000s, they basically decided not to use outboard motors. Mm-hmm. It was a conscious decision by the tribe to keep the old ways, to continue to use sails that are made out of palm leaves and wooden oars. But during that time, during the early 2000s, they decided to allow a smaller type of boat to use outboard motors.
Because you can see, and we've got pictures of those also in your book, much more. They don't look ancient at all. In fact, they've got English script and, you know,
right,
words on the side.
So those ones are almost like a legal loophole. So the tribe follows what are called the ways of the ancestors, which are a set of rules passed down by their ancestors, which basically dictate that for the ancient boats and for the whaling itself, they have to keep doing it according to the old script. However, some of the younger members of the tribe have basically figured out that the rules that apply to these ancient boats don't apply to the smaller boats. And so even though the small boats cannot attack whales, they are now used to gain advantages in the whaling. So rather than attach a motor directly to one of the ancient whaling boats, a rope can be tied from one of the smaller boats with an engine attached to it to one of the bigger boats that's normally used by sails and engines, and then dragged part of the way before being let go.
Well, I do want to talk more about this transition now, because this is really what you document in the stories of the people who are doing this today and the transition that they find themselves in. I want to get a couple more details too about what happens next. So they have to, now they've successfully caught the whale, they've killed the whale, they're going to bring it back. What happens now?
So they'll drag it to shore, and then they divide it up, which is a huge process that usually takes 2 days, as it's 40 or 50 tons of meat. But the key thing here is that all of that meat, literally every part of the whale, from the brains to the bones to all the meat and so on and so forth, is then divided up among the community to use. It's very hard for us as Westerners to think of whales being killed. Especially, whales are incredibly intelligent. They have a sense of self. Sperm whales themselves are considered to have language and to have very close family units. However, there are give or take 300,000 sperm whales in the world. The tribe takes about 20 of them a year, so it does not affect global populations. Indonesia is not a signatory to international whaling law. However, if it were, they would probably have an exemption under international whaling law for their kind of subsistence hunts. So once the whale is caught, they divide it up into, you know, thousands of smaller pieces, and then very equitably share that out among their tribe members. And for the very generous and equal way that they divide resources, anthropologists consider them to be one of the most generous groups in the world, in which that they are more likely to give away a resource or give more of the resource to someone else rather than keep it for themselves.
Let's talk more about the cultural differences, but also the cultural change. Because let's talk about some of the characters, the people who you met. John, for instance, is a member of the tribe who wants to be a harpooner. Introduce us to John and his story.
So John was a young man that I met near the beginning of my time there. And he had the misfortune of being involved in a whaling accident soon after I got there. His leg was crushed during a hunt, and it was unclear whether or not he was going to be able to achieve his childhood dream of becoming a harpooner, which is sort of the equivalent of becoming a basketball all-star or something for a child growing up in America. And as I followed him over the course of 3 years and spent, you know, about a year living with the Lamellarians during that time, I got to see him try and make a choice of whether or not he wanted to join the hunt and live in this sort of ancient way, or if he wanted to leave the tribe and try and find a modern job. So as much as the book is about, you know, the spectacular adventure of these hunts, it's even more about people trying to decide what the right way to live is in the modern world. It's trying to decide what are the value of our traditions and what are the value of these ancient ways of life, which give our world meaning, and which also provide us with food and with our whole livelihood, versus what are these amazing things that we see just over the horizon. You know, they have TV now, they are starting to get cell phones and so on and so forth. And they're very interested as well in what's in the outside world. So following John as he made that choice between living a modern and a traditional life was at the heart of the book.
And again, some of the tensions, you talk about a tradition of a father who very much wants to keep the tradition alive and a son who wants to be a DJ.
Yeah. So one of the other families that I followed in the book besides John, the father was a very legendary harpooner in the tribe. He was considered one of the best guardians of the old ways. But as often happens, fathers and sons differ in their desires. And one of that man's sons wanted to live a modern life, and he wanted to go be a DJ. And so in telling their story and investigating the different desires of both of them, I tried to illuminate the different advantages that each lifestyle can afford.
How new is this kind of tension in the community? Or, you know, it seems to me that exposure to those outside influences would be key. And if, you know, so how recent is that?
So the Lamellarians are very aware of the outside world. They have been very aware of the outside world for about a century, since missionaries really started to spend time with them. And what's so exceptional about the community is that until now, they have made the choice to continue to live with the old ways. They have mixed in small little bits and pieces of modernity when they have decided that those are good things. But they have also very consciously decided to defend their ancient way of living.
What about your influence in all of this? I mean, the fact that you go to this island, you say you're not the first. Clearly, this has been going on for some time. I mean, what about this? What would you say to someone who said, look, this is an act of voyeurism, that we as moderns want some kind of ancient exoticism, and that's what you're providing here? And it doesn't do them much good.
Well, I think that my goal was to help the Llama Lairns tell their story. Their story is the story of the 360 million other indigenous people in the world, as counted by the United Nations, who are experiencing globalization in a very complicated way. These are groups that do not have the choice of how modernity arrives to them. You know, their forests are getting cut down. Outside cultures are just sort of overwhelming their ancient traditions. And I was very, very lucky and to have the Llama Lairns' cooperation in doing this. You don't get to spend, 3 years with a group like this.
You learn their language as well, right?
Yeah. Without their cooperation. And this is a story that they wanted to tell. And I feel very thankful for their generosity and letting me tell that.
And you took drafts back to actually go over sections of the book?
Yes.
Is that right?
So, obviously as an outsider, it's impossible to stand exactly in their shoes. But my goal as a journalist, whether I'm writing about the Llama Lairns or any other subject, is to try and do as much work as possible to understand someone else's viewpoint as accurately as possible. And in this case, it meant living with them for months and months on end. It meant being one of the few outsiders to ever learn their native language. It meant, living their day-to-day with them exactly, from joining the hunts to helping them butcher whales to, gathering firewood. And so in the attempt to understand them was a very sincere and deep attempt on my part.
I want to talk about another member who you got to know a little bit. We talked about John, whose leg was crushed and wanted very much to be a harpooner. His sister also plays a role in this. Ika?
Ika.
Ika. Tell us about her, because she's someone who wants to be part of the modern world.
Yes. So, as with any large group of people, the Llama Lairns all have different sets of desires. Many of the young women do not always have the same advantages in the culture that some of the young men have. And so Ika was very curious about getting further education and trying to live a modern life. The freedoms afforded to young women in Llama Lair are not always equal to those afforded to young men. And so I tried to tell her story and to present what it meant to live in a traditional culture for a young woman of that type.
What percentage of the people, I think the population we said around 1,500, what percentage is actually engaged in whaling?
So there are a little over 300.
Whale hunting, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are a little over 300 active whalers, but essentially everyone is engaged. Every right. adult is engaged in the whaling. So those 300 would be men of prime age who are actively fighting the whales. But you have older men who are making the boats or weaving the sails or weaving the ropes. And then the women, of course, are all processing the whales. So the men go out and catch food in the morning or in the day, and then the women are tasked with processing, cutting it up, salting it, drying it, and so on and so forth.
What does the future look like for the Llama Lairns, do you think?
One thing that really amazed me was how much they were able to grapple with the outside world consciously. And anthropologists who lived with the Llama Lairns a generation ago assumed that their traditions would have vanished by now. However, they're still going strong, and that's because they're very conscious about how they decide to reckon with the outside world. And I think as long as they can do that, they'll continue to control their fate.
Doug Bach Clark is the author of The Last Whalers, 3 years in the far Pacific with a courageous tribe and a vanishing way of life. Going to be talking about his book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7 o'clock. And, of course, you can check out our website to find out more. Our website is stateofthings.org. Just ahead, award-winning choreographer of NBC's Jesus Christ Superstar. Stay with us.